What's up, Bills Mafia? It's Joe Marino from the Draft Network, and I'm your host of Locked On Bills. Happy Monday to you. I told you midweek last week that we were going to do this show concept where we look at the in-house options for the Bills to fill needs. Obviously, we're right on the doorstep of free agency. The draft is coming up. But I think it's important for us as we really get into those discussions moving forward to consider the players that already exist on the roster as players that could develop and fill the roles and fill the holes that the Bills need going into 2020. And to do that, reached out to my buddy Bruce Nolan. You guys know him from the Nick and Nolan Show on the Buffalo Rumblings podcast feed, of course, on Twitter at Bruce Exclusive. He was my fill-in host. He's been on this podcast quite a bit. So a man who probably doesn't need much introduction, but Bruce, really thrilled to have you with us today.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's always good to be back, and I think this is a fun topic to get into.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And Bruce, maybe you can start off here by telling the people how you're going to approach some of these questions and players that I bring up.
So when we start to dive into these players as potential replacements, it's important to make a delineation between what we think might happen and what we would prefer to see happen. And so with that, we decided to come up with specific tags. So for example, if we talk about player A potentially filling in for player B, there's four tags on the probability. Either there's highly likely, somewhat likely, somewhat unlikely, or highly unlikely. And that's our kind of predictive part of this podcast is, do we think it's going to happen? How much probability are we willing to put on it? If we were a betting man, what would we put on it? And then completely separate from that is how much that option particularly appeals to us. Highly unappealing, somewhat unappealing, somewhat appealing, or highly appealing, based on our personal beliefs about what that player is capable of and how they fill the gap.
My inspiration for this, obviously, I think it's important to look at the in-house options, guys that develop and claim bigger roles. But I always think back to listening to a press conference from Marv Levy, of all people, when he was the general manager for the Bills. And he was, you know, being asked about how he was going to improve the team over the offseason. And he kind of sharply said, listen, it's not always about bringing in guys outside the building. Sometimes you have players that just get better in with that you already have on the roster. And he referenced Brad Butler as a guy that was going to step up and fill an important role on the offensive line. And he did that. Now, Brad Butler didn't quite have the long sustained career that maybe we hoped, but he definitely answered a problem that the Bills have. And so that's kind of the objective here today, to look at some of the needs and talk about the in-house options. Let's start with the big one, Bruce, wide receiver. We know that this Buffalo Bills offense needs to score more touchdowns. They need to be more consistent in the passing game. There's a big thought out there that the Bills need a size receiver. But the reality is they just need more playmakers at wide receiver. And there's two guys that I think that exist on the roster outside of the known commodities and Cole Beasley and John Brown that I want to dig into. And I'd like to start with Robert Foster, a guy that had that really dynamic finish to his rookie season and then just couldn't help the team offensively this past season. What are your thoughts on if and predictively Robert Foster being able to claim a bigger role to fill the need for a playmaker in the offense and the passing game?
With Robert Foster, I have him tagged as highly unlikely. But the weird thing with Robert Foster is I'm not entirely sure why. It's kind of a bizarre situation with Robert Foster as to why he fell out of favor. But when you have a player who's already been cut by this regime and then broke out in the back half of 2018, only to suddenly be relegated to special teams, it appears highly unlikely that in his third year, he would now be entrusted to be a significant part of the offense after what's happened the first 2 years. I would also tag it with somewhat unappealing. Robert Foster was undrafted for a reason. He does have dynamic speed, but he's never been overly productive. He wasn't as a college player. And there have been some questions early on about how seriously he was taking his craft. And in both of these cases, the Duke Williams and the Robert Foster thing, the thing that makes me think that neither one of them is likely, I have them both tagged as highly unlikely, spoiler for the Duke discussion, but Brandon Bean came out and said, hey, we need touchdown makers, right? We absolutely need to go out and acquire touchdown makers, and specifically, we need Josh Allen to not feel like he has to do it all on his own. I feel like if the answer to the question was likely to be on the roster, that probably would have sounded different. It would have been either a more passive voice, like we need to score more touchdowns, not we need to get touchdown makers. There's a big difference between those two statements. One of them is in the passive voice and one of them is the active voice. And if you have someone who was cut before and you have someone who broke out and then very quickly got relegated to special teams only, it appears highly likely. And the appeal for you to put that onus on someone who was undrafted 2 years ago doesn't really do a lot for me. I would classify it as being somewhat unappealing.
I have a little bit of a hard time with it because he did have that stretch of games in 2018 when literally nobody could produce for the offense that he came out and had, you know, pretty rare production for a rookie wide receiver that had all the circumstances that you had already outlined for us. So I'm not going to say that it's completely highly unappealing for him to fill that role. I will say that it is somewhat unappealing just because there is some evidence that he can be a productive player. Predictively, I think you make good points about, you know, this regime would not have went through the steps it has with Robert Foster, a guy that even going back to his days at Alabama had familiarity with Brian Daboll, for Brandon Bean to be so open about how this team needs touchdown makers. And hello, Robert Foster exists. He's still on the roster. I think he has a chance to come back and be the gunner and maybe do some gadgety type stuff in the passing game. But I would say it's highly unlikely that the Bills view Robert Foster as an in-house option to fill this need for a playmaker in the passing game, which now shifts our discussion to the other guy on the roster that maybe has a chance to do this. And that is a big fan favorite, Duke Williams. Bruce, we've talked about Duke a lot. I know independently on our own podcast and of course on Twitter and those types of things, a guy that, you know, in the Tennessee game, he made some meaningful plays. The Jets game, the Bills didn't win that game, but he made some meaningful plays in addition to some errors. And then he was the most targeted wide receiver for Josh Allen in the playoffs against Houston. Tell us your predictions and your analytical side on Duke.
So I have Duke listed as highly unlikely as well for a lot of the same reasons that I have Robert Foster. Entrusting a role that important to a player that you picked up off the street last year seems highly unlikely to me. It seems that Brandon Bean would not go in with one in the hand and say, no, I think we're good there. I think Duke Williams has got us taken care of there. Now, anything Duke Williams gives you potentially next year, if he takes a step forward and, you know, does that, that's great and that's gravy, but it shouldn't be counted on. So I would make an argument that's probably highly unlikely for him to emerge as that guy. I would say it's somewhat unappealing, not highly unappealing, because we saw that Duke Williams can play the game. Like you said, 10 targets in a playoff game with Houston. But if I'm Brandon Bean, I'm looking at that going, okay, that tells me more about Josh Allen than it does about Duke Williams. Because I know that Josh Allen is going to make those throws to contested catch guys. What if I could find someone more talented than Duke Williams? That's what my mind would lead toward. I have this draft capital. I know that Josh Allen has now checked that box for willing to throw to a player of that type. What if I can find someone like that who's got more reliable hands, who can separate a little bit better, things like that. And that actually lends itself, his targets in the playoff game might lend itself towards actually trying to upgrade rather than viewing it the opposite direction. So I have it as highly unlikely, but somewhat unappealing.
I have nothing to add. I agree with you on both fronts, and I want to shift our discussion now to the left guard position where Quentin Spain is a free agent. And there's some guys on this roster, Bruce, that have been around for a little bit, some guys that played some last year, some guys that maybe could flip positions and help fill this hole. So before we consider Quentin Spain as returning as the starting left guard, or before we consider a new player being brought in to start next to Deion Dawkins, does that answer exist on the team? And I'd like to start with Spencer Long, a guy who Bills signed early in free agency after he was released from the Jets, kind of filled that backup interior offensive line role as the center slash guard combo Can he be the answer at left guard?
I have Spencer Long written down as somewhat likely and somewhat appealing. So the interesting thing about Spencer Long is his contract. His contract is really unique, right? It was basically 1 year and then team options. But the team options pay him like a starting guard, which means that they kind of protected themselves from the Quentin Spain departure with these team options on Spencer Long. In addition, they scooped up Spencer Long very quickly after the Jets cut him. But Quentin Spain was brought in much, much later in the free agency period. When you think about this, you think to themselves, goodness gracious, they really prioritized getting Spencer Long. Now, of course, at the time, you know, unrestricted free agency hadn't kicked off yet. But when you evaluate the contracts that they both got, you think to yourself, okay, the team obviously thinks he can be a starting left guard because there wouldn't be options in his contract for those contingencies if they thought it was completely impossible. If they thought, hey, listen, you're a backup swing interior lineman, that's all you're ever going to be, it would seem weird that there would be contract options that would pay him reasonably like a starting guard. So that means I feel like it's somewhat likely. I feel like that's probably a contingency plan that was built in for scenarios like this. In addition, it's somewhat appealing to me. We all know Spencer Long was a free agent bust with the Jets. He was also playing out of position and with a hand injury. So that stuff has to be taken into consideration. How quickly we forget how interesting it was when he was coming from Washington and the Jets picked him up and people were like, wow, that's what a great signing for the Jets. And that was not that long ago. So when you take those things into consideration, I think somewhat likely and somewhat appealing for me.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bruce. And the deal with Spencer Long, and I guess when you look at roster construction as a whole, is that you're just not going to have this high-dollar elite starter at every spot. And you need players that are serviceable that can fill holes for you. And one of those spots that you feel reasonably can be done by an average player is your left guard spot. So I think that there is some appeal there for both the reasons that I think he can do it and also that you have an economic option as one of your starters and a guy that, you know, it's not like he's an unknown commodity in the league. He's played a bit and we kind of know that he can adequately fill in. Now, here's a player that I have really no idea if he can adequately fill in, but this is year three in on the team, right? Ike Bocker. Bills have had him around since 2018. He's a UDFA out of Iowa. Again, just always rostered and hasn't played much at all, but he's been around. And sometimes I when I think about Sean McDermott, especially the guys that are around, I think that there's something to that. Should we be thinking about Ike Bocker as a guy that can really challenge, whether that's Spencer Long or some other guys brought in to be the Bills starting left guard?
I have Ike Bocker listed as highly unlikely, but not because I don't think the coaching staff has faith in him. Like you said, he's been around for multiple years. You don't keep this person on your roster if you don't believe he has something. The reason I have him listed as highly unlikely is because I think he might be hurt by his flexibility. I think that the reason why the team is keeping him on is not necessarily to start him. His ability to play many positions, all of the ones on the offensive line, and potentially be brought in as a sixth offensive lineman is something that I think the team finds valuable. So even though they're keeping him around, I don't think they're keeping him around for that reason. I think they think, listen, the versatility allows us to be more flexible with other spots on the roster. And if we can get satisfactory play from him, even if it's not necessarily starting caliber play, then that's worth keeping him around. I have him as highly unlikely and somewhat unappealing because I haven't seen anything from Ike Bocker thus far in his career that would make me feel more comfortable with him at that left guard spot than Spencer Long.
The Bills have a unique amount of players that can snap the football. You don't normally see this. They have Mitch Morse, John Feliciano, Spencer Long, Ryan Bates, and Ike Bocker. That's five guys. I mean, that's not normal. You usually have like two, maybe three. So the Bills really do value that interior flexibility as evidenced by those players and players that they've rostered in the past with Sean McDermott. Jeremiah Searles comes to mind as well. So position flex is definitely something that when we're thinking about the players, the offensive linemen that Brandon Bean's going to bring into the building, he wants guys that can play multiple spots. And that leads us to our next guy. And this is an interesting one. Cody Ford, the Bills' second round pick from 2019. Pretty much played the whole season at right tackle, got a few reps at right guard. A lot of belief, I know from you and other people that I respect within the Bills community, think that he's a better guard than he is tackle. Could he be viewed as an answer at left guard? And then you kind of turn to Ty Nsekhe, or maybe you bring back LaAdrian Waddle to be the, you know, swing tackle. Do you think that he's a realistic option for the Bills, or at least should he be at guard?
I have Cody Ford listed as somewhat unlikely, but highly appealing. So big gap between those two things. The reason I say somewhat unlikely for Cody Ford is because I think they're going to give him every opportunity to fail at tackle. And I don't think anyone can look at his 2019 and say definitively that he failed at tackle. He had some nice games at tackle. In addition, he compares very favorably to somebody that they saw in Carolina being Darrell Williams, who ironically enough shifted inside to guard. But he played at right tackle for Carolina and was talked about as potentially being a Bills free agent pickup last year for the whole Buffalo-Carolina connection. And I think that they're going to give him every opportunity to fail there. They made it very clear when they drafted him, they viewed him as a tackle first, but liked his versatility. Now, in the year-end press conference, Bean said, listen, we're not going to peg him. We like his versatility. He just doesn't want to get pinned down if they find an elite right tackle prospect who falls to him in the second round, or Jack Conklin's price ends up being better than thought in free agency. But I have every confidence that they're not going to move him yet. I just don't think that unless they find someone who they think is a really good right tackle, then in that case, great. Ford's versatility is a wonderful thing. But I think multiple things have to happen for that to happen first. The first would be Quentin Spain would have to leave in free agency to even open the spot. And the second thing would be they would have to find a right tackle they felt really good about, because it's clear they don't believe that Ty Nsekhe can hold up at right tackle for 16 games, or they wouldn't have been platooning them to begin with. So my opinion is it's somewhat unlikely that he'll be the answer, but highly appealing. I loved Cody Ford as a guard prospect coming out last year. I think that his length, his power, I mean, dude is throwing dudes out of the club. And it is something that you love to see, and you love to watch that level of power and drive. I remember when you could watch Cody Ford and Deion Dawkins next to each other in practice and preseason, or Cody Ford and Ty Nsekhe next to each other, and you could just turn that entire side of the line because of having that drive blocker on the inside at guard. And I think it would be highly appealing to me, but I'm not necessarily sure it's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm interested in it, Bruce. It may be the best thing for Cody Ford, but I almost feel like the best thing for Cody Ford is for him to get a spot, stick there, learn the nuance, and become the best player that he can be. I think the musical chairs is detrimental to Cody Ford. So I kind of have this belief, though, that Brandon Bean, Sean McDermott really want to give him every single opportunity to stick there at right tackle, but I don't think we can dismiss him as an option potentially on the interior. Remember the days when you were always ready to go? Now you can increase your performance and get extra confidence in bed. Listen up, BlueChew.com. That's blue like the color blue. BlueChew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. And since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. Now this just isn't for guys who can't perform. It's for any guy who wants extra function to enhance their performance in the bedroom. Blue Chew is prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package, so no in-person doctor's visits, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Right now, we've got a deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code LOCKEDON. Just pay $5 for shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code LOCKEDON to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, Bruce, a couple more spots to consider here on the offensive side of the football, and we're going to do the defensive side tomorrow as well, so make sure you guys don't miss that. Come back and listen to us talk through the defensive in-house options to fill big holes on the roster. But before we do, I was really excited to learn that The Nick and Nolan show was no longer a once-per-week affair moving forward. I know that you're doing a lot more writing over at Buffalo Rumbling, so if you can, I'd love to hear definitively what's going to be happening with your content as well as Nick Badalana, your wonderful co-host over there at Nick and Nolan. What's going to be happening here in the coming weeks?
Well, we're really excited, Joe, that Buffalo Rumblings has been wonderful to us, and they've been really excited and supportive of our work. And the Nick and Nolan show, effective last week, has gone Thursdays and Fridays every week. And that will be continue to be that way throughout the offseason. When the regular season comes around, we'll evaluate how we're doing at that point. But Thursdays and Fridays throughout the offseason is going to be the plan. And sometimes you'll get one big topic that's split in two, much like you and I are doing right now. Sometimes you'll have two separate topics. It'll just give us a lot more flexibility as far as keeping up with all the topics we want to do, because we have a lot of great ideas of things we want to do. And sometimes it doesn't work out for whatever reasons, and we want to be able to get everything out that we want to get out. As far as the website goes, both Nick and I write on average 8 pieces a month for Buffalo Rumblings. Now, last year, he did an opinion column during the regular season that would drop on Mondays, and I did an analysis column that would drop on Fridays. And they were really well received. The community has been unbelievably gracious to us. And Buffalo Rumblings came and talked to us and said, hey, let's do a little more. And we agreed to do a little more. So I think we're going to get Nick and Nolan twice a week, and we're going to get written contact from each of us twice a week, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'm excited for it. I've been joking with you guys for a while about doing a more regular pod, completely for selfish reasons, not with any regard to your families and what you have going on. I just wanted to listen to it more and have it available more per week. So I know that I didn't have anything to do with that, but I'm happy for selfish reasons, and I'm looking forward to more Nick and Nolan, both in the written and spoken form. And whatever you're listening to this podcast on, you guys can find the Nick and Nolan Show as part of the Buffalo Rumblings podcast feed. Hit that subscribe button and don't miss any of their episodes that come out on Thursdays and Fridays moving forward. All right, Bruce, back up running back to Devin Singletary. Everybody knows it. The Bills are going to have multiple backs touch the football in every game. Devin Singletary is the lead back, but we can't have Frank Gore or somebody of that caliber touching the football when Devin Singletary steps out of the game. So there's two guys that are currently on the roster, and I'm interested to find out if you think either one of these two guys have a chance to be the answer at backup running back to Devin Singletary. Let's start with the more proven player, TJ Yeldon, former high pick of the Jaguars, was there for 4 years. They let him walk, and he came on a very modest 2-year deal with the Bills. Always thought it was interesting that he signed a 2-year deal, and there was a thought in my mind that they wanted him to be here for this season. Well, is he going to be the backup to Devin Singletary? Your thoughts on if you want that to be the case and if you think it will be the case?
I have TJ Yeldon as somewhat unlikely, but highly unappealing. The only reason I don't have him as highly unlikely is exactly what you said. He signed a 2-year contract, which was specifically chosen so that they wouldn't go into this year absolutely needing to fill it. Well, they don't need to fill it from a contractual standpoint, but they do need to fill it because TJ Yeldon is not nearly the caliber of running back we need if we're going to be splitting carries 60-40, 70-30, 50-50. Because the drop-off from Devin Singletary to TJ Yeldon is notable. He has a very unique sort of upright running style. It opens him up to a lot of big hits, which in turn opens him up to potential fumble problems, which we saw from TJ Yeldon. I like his receiving ability out of the backfield. It's nice to have another body on the roster right now, as opposed to just having Devin Singletary and then Christian Wade. So it's nice to have an extra body on there. But if TJ Yeldon is taking meaningful carries for you down the stretch run toward a playoff push, I would not particularly feel comfortable with that. So for me, it's somewhat unlikely, but highly unappealing.
I got to give my brother, Frank, some credit for this take when it comes to TJ Yeldon. And we watch all the Bills games together and obviously talk about the Bills all the time. And, you know, we both just talk football all the time. And whenever he watched TJ Yeldon run the football last year, whether it was preseason or the few times he got a chance to do it in regular season games, he said, man, he's just so tackleable. And that's not a good quality to have as a running back. And I don't disagree. He just offers a lot of surface area with his style. The one thing that people get hung up on with TJ Yeldon, Bruce, is the fact that there's this perception that he's a good receiving back. And we all want Josh Allen to get running backs more involved in the passing game. I mean, like, what do you think? Is there just a reason in your mind where he's not been able to fill that niche role for this offense, or is it just that he's too limited elsewhere? Or does this kind of tie into some of the stuff you talked about last week about specialization and predictability?
That's exactly where I was going with it. Having a third down running back is great if the third down running back can catch passes and potentially block. If the third down running back can only catch passes, then you're tipping your hand early on these kind of things. And one of the ways that, you know, these receiving backs can really get out in space, you know, Texas routes out of the backfield, little flares, things like that, is because there is an idea that they might stay in and block. And if they, someone brings a blitz on third and long, that this guy can stand in there and block. And I don't think TJ Yeldon's overly special in that sort of way. And so when you bring him on the field, you are tipping your hand a little bit. I think he's got a lot of, he's got a lot of pub around that receiving thing. And that is something he does well. He has good hands. He's smooth, natural hands. And part of it's because he's gotten a ton of practice at it. You know, the Devin Singletary discussion, just because someone didn't do something doesn't mean they can't do something. And so when the Bills sent a running backs coach down to see if Devin Singletary was someone who could catch out of the backfield, we don't have to do that with TJ Yeldon because in Jacksonville, he got lots of targets. And so we're like, okay, he's a good receiving back because of the receptions. But good receiving back isn't just how many passes you caught. It's about your effectiveness after the catch. It's about how well you run your routes. It's about all these other things. And I think he is a good receiving back, but it might be a little bit overblown.
Yeah, I think that's fair. All right, there's probably people that saw the topic of this podcast and have been waiting for us to get to this guy and the Christian Wade fan club. They all have your ear right now, Bruce. Can Christian Wade predictively, and of course, your analytical approach to the idea of him being the meaningful backup to Devin Singletary in 2020?
Please don't yell at me. Okay, with that being said, I have Christian Wade as highly unlikely and highly unappealing, but hear me out. Highly unlikely because the program he's a part of gives you an 11th practice squad spot for 2 years, not 1 year. If you have an opportunity to develop this guy for another year who has, reminder, never played football before last year, didn't know how to run to the right holes, doesn't understand blocking concepts, doesn't know where his eyes are supposed to be. We have no idea if he can pass block. Running routes is completely foreign to him. When you have that and you have a built-in system where you don't have to make that call right now, you don't have to make the either put him on the roster or lose him forever call right now. Now, you do have to cut him to get him to the practice squad. But again, is he going to get the amount of carries necessary in the preseason where someone's going to be like, yes, I want to develop that guy who doesn't quite know how to play running back yet? So having an extra spot on your practice squad for 2 years makes it seem like it's highly unlikely because I think we're going to use both of those years up. The reason why it's highly unappealing to me is not because he's not a dynamic athlete in space, because he absolutely is, but having someone who's going to get meaningful carries. Sean McDermott openly said, this is not about spelling Devin Singletary occasionally for a rep or two when he gets tired. He openly said it is not good to have a running back carry the whole load. That sounds a lot more to me like 70, 30, 60, 40. That's what it sounds like to me. And if I'm going to devote a significant workload to an offense that we want to be able to run the ball to a guy who just learned how to play football, that's high risk for me. Very, very, very high risk. And because it's high risk, that's why it's highly unappealing.
Yeah, we need to learn a lot more about Christian Wade, and maybe we'll talk about this differently after the preseason. But at this point, it's impossible, I think, to have a different approach, having a reasonable mindset regarding the situation. Let's shift gears to the tight end position. This is an interesting one because really the root of this is I want the Bills to run more 12 personnel, and from our Twitter interactions, I think you do as well. I think it can really help Josh Allen in a lot of ways. The Bills looked at getting Greg Olsen as well, who's a Seattle Seahawk. He's not going to be part of the team, but at least gave us some clue that they could be interested in upgrading the tight end position. Dawson Knox is the guy. I think we all understand that. He needs to clean up the drops, but he's got every physical skill in the world to be a dynamic tight end, and he was at times last year. But if the Bills wanted to incorporate more of a tight end two look, more 12 personnel, how appealing are these guys in your mind? We'll start with Tyler Kroft.
I have Tyler Kroft as somewhat likely, but somewhat unappealing. I think he's somewhat likely simply because he's under contract and the Bills have the same hope for him in 2020 that they had in 2019, because they drafted Dawson Knox having Tyler Kroft on the team. So they already knew at that point they had Tyler Kroft, and they probably have the same ideas for what the two of them together could be that they did after they drafted Dawson Knox in 2019. The contract is, at this point, able to be gotten out of, and if there's an opportunity to upgrade, we're going to take that opportunity. Brandon Bean always talks about that. We're always looking to upgrade. We're always looking to upgrade. That, to me, is what the Greg Olsen was. The flirtation with Greg Olsen was primarily a, hey, we have an opportunity to upgrade with a guy we know and a guy we trust and a guy we saw be meaningful with a young quarterback in Carolina. Let's take a shot at this thing. I don't think that's necessarily displeasure at Tyler Kroft's ability to play in 12 personnel sets. So because of that, I have it listed being as somewhat likely. I think, obviously, like everybody else, they would like Tyler Kroft to stay healthy. But they signed him with the idea that he can be a meaningful contributor. He got paid like a meaningful contributor. And so that's why I have that. Now, with the somewhat unappealing, this is why. Brandon Bean says we need touchdown makers. If you're going to run 12 personnel, now it's a versus scenario. Tyler Kroft versus your third wide receiver. And that doesn't move the needle significantly for me right now. I mean, right now you can pick, as far as touchdown makers, people who can be dynamic offensive playmakers, Tyler Kroft or Duke Williams. You know, Tyler Kroft or Isaiah McKenzie. It just doesn't jump out at me as obviously Tyler Kroft. I don't think anybody probably really responds, yes, absolutely, 100% Tyler Kroft. We're trying to get as many dynamic offensive playmakers on the field at the same time. I absolutely want Tyler Kroft instead of a third wide receiver. And that's why it's somewhat unappealing for me, even though I think it's somewhat likely.
Love what you said there. I think that was probably the most convincing thing I've heard in terms of, yeah, the Bills got to get more playmakers, because of those are the decisions, Bruce. Right there, Tyler Kroft or Isaiah McKenzie, in terms of personnel groupings to score touchdowns. Yeah, they've got to get more playmakers. All right, Tommy Sweeney, Bill's seventh round pick. He's got some fans out there, man. I've seen these people on Twitter. They love Tommy Sweeney. Can he be a solution and a dynamic guy to be a 12 personnel tight end?
I have Tommy Sweeney as being somewhat unlikely, but somewhat unappealing. Somewhat unlikely because when he came back, Tyler Kroft came back, he started to take away snaps from Sweeney almost immediately. So whatever Sweeney showed them in practice was not as effective as what they thought Tyler Kroft could be healthy. So from a picking order standpoint, it's pretty clear that even though Tyler Kroft was injured, when he came back, he started to take away some of that Tommy Sweeney. And we know Tommy Sweeney stepped in as TE1 during the camp and preseason and did a great job. But the reason it's somewhat unappealing to me is you're always going to have limited athletic upside with Tommy Sweeney. I'm not saying Tommy Sweeney can't be a contributing player in this league, because I think he can. Nick and I talked about this after we drafted him, that if this was 30 years ago, Tommy Sweeney could be your starting tight end and be completely okay with that. But as the game has evolved into more dynamic tight ends, Tommy Sweeney doesn't have that dynamic athleticism that you like to, where you go, okay, I can have a third wide receiver or I can have Tommy Sweeney. Absolutely, I want Tommy Sweeney. And that's just, he's a good enough blocker. He's a good enough route runner. He does a good job of finding holes in zones. I trust him to be where he's going to be. I trust his hands to be reasonable. I think he's a completely reasonable rosterable player, and I'd like him to stay on the roster. But if you're going to tell me, hey, he's going to be our 12 personnel guy, he's going to give you that dynamic option across from Dawson Knox, that is somewhat unappealing to me.
Yeah. I felt like they wanted him to be something this year. Like, he got some targets in preseason and even early on. I was like, wow, like Tommy Sweeney might be a thing. And then it didn't really evolve much. Let's throw one more guy in the mix here. Jason Groom didn't play at all last year, but had some moments in 2018. He's got a lot more athletic ability than some of these guys we've been talking about. Is he a forgotten man that could be looked at as a player to help this offense as tight end two in 2020?
I have it as highly unlikely and highly unappealing. Highly unappealing because I don't ever think that Jason Kroom kind of evolved past being a big wide receiver. You know, for those of you who don't know, he was a transitionary player from wide receiver to tight end. And I didn't really feel like he ever really got the rest of the game, aside from just being a big wide receiver, although I do like his athleticism. I say highly unlikely because before Jason Kroom got hurt, the Bills brought in Sweeney, Croft, and Knox, all before Kroom got hurt. So I don't think you bring in three tight ends, right? One of which you pay a decent contract to, one of which you draft in the third round, and the other one you take a reasonable contract on, if you really believe that Kroom has a chance. I don't think it's something that you say, you know what, we're totally going to bank on Kroom being able to be that guy. In addition, I don't know if he's going to necessarily have the opportunity to show he's the guy, because you're going to have three healthy tight ends ahead of him getting reps, and that's assuming we don't draft one. So I'm not even entirely sure he's going to have the opportunity. I think he's a roster bubble player right now, and I don't think that he's going to get the opportunity to even show he could be.
Bruce, I have one more for you. This is off script. I didn't warn you that I was going to ask you about this, but I do want to quickly talk about the quarterback situation. Josh Allen's a starter, but I talked in my performance review series about Matt Barkley and that I do have concerns about him being the backup quarterback. And if Josh were to get hurt, that, you know, the season wouldn't just be gone. And we've seen teams overcome their starting quarterback, get hurt, and they have a meaningful backup that comes in, and you know, the season's not completely lost. And when you think about Matt Barkley as the primary backup to Josh, when you think about Davis Webb as the practice squad quarterback, that would be, I guess, next man up. What are your thoughts on these two guys being behind Josh going into the season? And I mean, is there any chance that it's a different combination of passers behind Josh?
I'd say the chances of it happening are fairly unlikely. I would put that as highly unlikely that we end up with a different QB2, but it is somewhat appealing to me to have a different QB2. I liked Davis Webb coming out. I enjoyed Davis Webb. I thought that he had a chance to kind of grow and groom in the Giants organization. They had all that turnover with coaches and quarterbacks coaches and offensive schemes. And then he ended up with the Jets. And I was like, okay, well, maybe there's something there and the Jets not so much. And I was pleased when we got Davis Webb, because I actually think that he has there's still some potential upside in Davis Webb. However, I would be really, really happy if we drafted Anthony Gordon in the mid rounds.
Yeah.
I know no one's going to really love that take, but I would very much not like to have a Josh Allen injury kill the season. And I like Matt Barkley. I think he's been great. I think having him in the absence of Derek Anderson was helpful for Josh Allen. I think Josh Allen has graduated past the need for Matt Barkley. And I think that's important. I think he's moved past the need to have Matt Barkley in his ear coaching him up. And I think he's at the point now where we can get somebody as a backup quarterback who serves more purpose than just hold this clipboard and build Josh up. And so I would be in favor of trying to upgrade that QB2 spot. If that's via Davis Webb continuing to grow within the system and outplaying Matt Barkley, great. But if we drafted a, you know, fifth round quarterback, I'm not going to hate it.
Yeah, me neither. I've expressed my concerns about it here on this podcast. So I guess no one else is talking about it. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the situation, Bruce. Thanks so much for joining me here today on this podcast. Bruce and I will be back again for you tomorrow. We're going to flip over to the defensive side of the football, talk about some of the holes that exist on the roster, and if any of the guys that currently exist can step in and fill those roles adequately, both from an analytical perspective in addition to a predictive side. Make sure you guys are following Bruce on Twitter at Bruce Exclusive. Make sure you're subscribed to the Nick and Nolan Show as part of the Buffalo Rumblings podcast feed. And then I also do kindly ask that you share, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast as well. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again for you tomorrow.